The views and opinions expressed by host and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of the Global Liberty Alliance, its network, sponsors, donors, or broadcast platforms. The Global Liberty Alliance provides this podcast for informational purposes. Freedom of speech is a fundamental right and essential for free societies to prosper. Thank you for listening and supporting the mission of the Global Liberty Alliance, dedicated to strengthening and defending fundamental individual rights, free markets, and the rule of law.
And welcome to another Global Liberty Alliance podcast. Thank you for joining us. As always, we're happy you have joined us. Today, we are honored to have with us a true Cold War warrior who continues to fight the good fight on human rights, fundamental rights, rule of law, not just here, but in many countries around the world. Ambassador Martin Palaus, a former Czech diplomat who is currently the senior fellow at FIU's Florida International University of International Public Affairs and director of the Vaclav Havel Program for Human Rights and Diplomacy. He wrote an article recently in the Miami Herald, at least for those of us who follow the Cuba issue and have been following it for a long time, as I know Martin has for a long time, and he's actually worked on this for a long time as well, titled, "It's Time for Leaders in Cuba and Exiles in Miami to Sit Down and Talk." Now, folks, for those of you who don't follow this issue, that's probably sounds like a very good idea, but it has also created a huge discussion, a good one, one that I think is long overdue. And I'm so glad that Ambassador Palaus is with us today to talk a little bit more about this and some of his work in this space. And Martin, how are you doing today? Thank you for joining us.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me in this program. If I am to react to your questions, I need to start a little bit from my historical background and context.
Yeah, it'd be awesome to hear that. Yes.
I am now dual citizen. I have also U.S. passport, but my original homeland is Czechoslovakia, later Czech Republic. So I was exposed in my life to the totalitarian regime that was existing there for more than four decades, half of my life. And certainly the resistance or the way how people were reacting to that situation is something what is still guideline for me in my current actions as well. So I was a spokesperson for Charter 77, which was a human rights movement in which we offered a dialogue about the question of human rights to our communist government. We were not expecting that they would be willing to talk to us seriously, but obviously it was a challenge and question whether these governments were even willing and able to consider the question of human rights. It was a so-called Helsinki process, the peaceful relations between states with different political and social systems. But our resistance was, I was rather existential. We wanted not to participate in this situation. And then, just going quickly forward, Velvet Revolution came. Velvet Revolution certainly was, I would say, initiated from two sides. We were some sort of nucleus of civil society. It was called Parallel Police, and we had some ideas we were ready to fight for, but also international context was important. It was when Ronald Reagan was in power, and then George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, President Bush 41, and on the Soviet side, Mikhail Gorbachev with his perestroika. And in this situation, out of sudden, this miraculous year, 1989, brought us into a very different situation. Now my Cuban friends are very, they like to say very often that they would love to use our experience, follow our example, and do the same thing. Obviously, Cuba is not Czech Republic. Central Europe is not island in Caribbean. There are differences here, but obviously similarities. But when I'm now thinking about Velvet Revolution, it was started with a student demonstration, then demonstrations on the street. We founded a kind of a revolutionary political body called Civic Forum. But the key thing was a communication that started between Václav Havel, who was the visible face, then president of Czechoslovakia and Czech Republic of the revolution, and Prime Minister Adamec. Prime Minister Adamec, who was a communist, who was living on the other side, and he had to discuss about all these things with his comrades, with maybe Stalinists and other more conservative members of Politburo and Communist Party. But after Havel and Adamec met, day after day, things started to change. I think that the truth was that the other side had power. We were not troubled by that question, which now seems to be troubling for many Cuban friends of mine, that by talking to the other side means that you give them some legitimacy they don't deserve. It was not a question of legitimacy. It was a question how we can get from A to B, how we can start a process moving from status quo to some better future. And if you go to Poland, the same thing. General Jaruzelski was at the round table with dissidents and his opponents like Lech Walesa. Actually, he was president till December of 1990. So what I'm telling now to my Cuban friends is not that they should, enroll themselves to the agenda that is presented by the current government of Cuba, which means Díaz-Canel and his people, but try to open channels of communication and tell loud and clear what would be confidence-building measures so that things can move forward. And obviously, as I wrote in my piece, it should be the release of political prisoners, some sort of communication dialogue with democratic opposition, and all of that. I think that we should endlessly debate what is the situation of Cuban government right now. I think they are in big trouble. Economically, if you look at the numbers of people who are leaving Cuba now, trying to go to the United States in the first place, I think that all of that gives me a belief that to test the other side is a meaningful choice.
We're talking with Martin Palaus, former Czech diplomat, a longtime human rights defender. Martin, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Go back a minute to your experience behind the Iron Curtain. We don't have a lot of time today for that, but I just want to get some context for those people who may not be familiar with it. How important was the Prague Spring of 68 in what led to 89? You were in the middle of that. And of course, I studied that in high school and graduate school. And for people today, how do you contextualize that phase of the beginning of the end, if you will, of the Cold War?
Look, I was a teenager, so I was perceiving the situation from my juvenile perspective. For me, the first half of 1968 was a great time, change and hope. We could finally start traveling to the West. We were enjoying some sort of freedom and were not so much following the discussions between factions or of the Communist Party, whether socialism can be endowed with human face or not. But it was a time of hope, and the funny thing was that the first secretary of Communist Party, Mr. Dubček, was pretty popular person among Czechoslovak citizens. And then the blow connected with the Soviet-led invasion in August of that year, it was very unpleasant message to us that no matter whatever Czechs and Slovaks wanted, we had to accept the realities of the Cold War, Europe divided to East and West to two parts, And unfortunately, after the Second World War, Czechoslovakia was part of the Soviet Empire. And so we were just satellite. And then, so it was a very difficult blow. How you can react as a young man, as I was, to such a situation? You can try to leave the country and start somewhere else, because communism is another great atmosphere or place to live in. Or you can find a way how to accommodate yourself to the situation, or you can try to look for the third way. And it was the dissident's way. It was our parallel Polish Charter 77, just to create small island of freedom surrounded by this totalitarian nonsense. So and we did that. It was the resistance, and it led us, it took us some time, 21 years, to the revolution of 1989.
Well, and that's I'm glad you couched it that way, because that's exactly where I was leading to with your article, this new generation, and kind of unpack a little bit about what you said in the opening there, that really what happened in Cuba July 11th last year, I've been saying it could be Cuba's 1989. But if you look back and you go back to, as you know, 1997, La Patria es de Todos, which you allude to in your piece, I mean, Cuba has these great thinkers, and we had, you know, people like Oswaldo Payá, you know, God rest his soul. He's no longer with us. We have, you know, Oscar Bisset. Of course, the Patria de Todo was put together by Felix Antonio Bonet, René Gómez Manzano, Vladimir Roca, Martha Betty Roque. I mean, there's so many other people I could talk about. People, some of them no longer with us, Laura Poyang, and José Daniel Ferrer, who's with us today. So there is this core group of people that's still there in Cuba fighting, I think, and they have been for a long time. I mean, what would you be your message to them? Because back in 97, in La Patria de Todo, I remember very clearly, and I had to brush up on it recently for the show, but I remember they closed it with, it's better to discuss solutions now than to mourn the loss of the homeland tomorrow. And they were talking about this back in 97. So do you think there's some type of connection with this historical dissident movement to this new movement today? What happened in 89 and where we're going to, excuse me, what happened in 2021 and what you're talking about today?
Look, I think that obviously there is a continuity of Cuban struggle for freedom. And you can go back to the beginning of the 20th century. This Criollo Republic, with all its ups and downs and shortcomings, but also some good things. And then the revolution, Castro's revolution, 1959. And then now efforts of generations of Cubans to find some better world for them than the one that is now being kept in existence for horrible amount of time by the current leadership and government. Obviously, there are two things. One thing is the will of Cuban people to reunify Cuban nation and to have some vision for the future. But on the other side is also our experience, this experience of all relatively small nations, plus minus 10 million inhabitants, the opportunities generated by international situation. In 1968, we could have had great ideas about freedom. There was a big demonstration. There were demonstrations, and 1969 was the first anniversary of the Soviet invasion. Czechoslovak people tried to speak out, but still it was heroic, but could not produce any results. For Cubans, you have a whole history, first, I would say, armed resistance, and then La Resistencia Pacifica Nonviolenta, these traditional people and some movements. You can go up from Lisardo Sanchez and Gustavo Arcos and till today. I think that today is very clear that we are talking about peaceful resistance, about the change that can be achieved by peaceful means. And this peaceful means, I think, needs to follow the international situation, to test the other side. But in the end of the day, you have to open a channel of communication with someone on the other side who might be willing to listen to your arguments, also trying to bring in the perspective that the other side has. The other side, I mean, the Cuban government today, I think they are in deadlock situation. They are in blind alley. What they want to offer to Cubans in 2022. And I think that for Cuba, there is a great option, reunification of Cuban nation. The role of exile community, especially here in the United States, and especially here in Florida, but also in Europe, in reconstruction of the Cuban Republic. But obviously, you need to get rid of totalitarian habits. You need to reinstate the rule of law, respect for human rights, and find some sort of peaceful transition. I think that I'm not suggesting that it is something what's going to happen because of the loss of history dictate that, but it is an opportunity that should not be missed.
So let me ask you a question about that.
Happy.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I would be happy to act as a kind of mediator, but it's not for me to make any decision. It's up to Cuban leaders in the exile community here, what they want to come up with, what are their conditionalities, what kind of steps can be taken so that things start moving from the current stalemate to some better future.
I agree with you that we have to move beyond this stalemate. In fact, during the pandemic, we had a great conversation over in D.C. You were passing through town, and we talked a little bit about some of this, and we'll share with some folks some information about that conversation that led to a paper. Let me ask you a question about a two-part question. One has to do with your experience with transitional justice and forgiveness in the Czech Republic, because that is an issue, by the way, that still, I think, when you talk to exile leaders, and depending on what group you talk to, and I've had a great conversation a few years ago with Elizardo Sanchez. In fact, the first time we had ever spoken, and we're probably at ideologically different ends of the spectrum. But it was an interesting conversation. We talked a little bit about this issue, and I've talked to many exile leaders and groups about an issue nobody wants to talk about, and it has to do with transitional justice and forgiveness. Some people want it to happen now. Some people don't want it to happen at all. Some people ignore it. How does a community that still has, I guess, on this side, a lot of pain, and my family suffered that pain. I mean, I was born here, but they lost everything. My parents were not rich people, but they were hardworking people, and they lost what was most important. They lost their freedom. They were persecuted because of their faith. They were called some very horrible things, and they had to start over again. What do you tell folks who say, look, how do you get beyond this when people are still obviously in a lot of pain? And when do you deal with transition justice, or can we deal with transition justice at this stage of the process?
Look, transitional justice is a tricky thing. We need to put each case, Cuban case and Czechoslovak case, into larger historical context. We have questions that were opened by Nuremberg trial after the Second World War. Because obviously, what kind of legal principles should be used in the process of, to serve justice? Obviously, if you have war criminals or those criminals that committed crimes against humanity or genocides, I think that the answer is very clear. But then when you go through the whole society, then you start thinking also about reconciliation. You have a South African case with these truth commissions. So you have many, many models, and Cubans need to find the model for themselves. I would be the last saying that the only thing you should do is to draw a thick line and separate the future from the past. The past is present, and people have a right to tell their stories. And if the story was a story of persecution, there are also people who did persecution. So they might be tried and made responsible and punished for what they were doing. But at the same time, we should not forget about the process that should lead to some sort of reunification, reconciliation. I can imagine that in Cuban context now, you can have whole families with internal conflicts. La abuela is still believing in her understanding of Cuban revolution and grandchildren demonstrating on the streets for Patria para Todos. So I think that we need to find a way how to make a new beginning. New beginning doesn't mean to forgive everything. I think that some sort of judgment must be pronounced, a truth must be searched for and stated if possible. So you have to have some sort of memory institutions, but also institutions that are in charge of serving justice as courts and other bodies created for this purpose.
Do you think that you're a good student of the Cuban diaspora? Do you think the diaspora is ready for this? You know, in your piece in the Miami Herald, you actually wrote that a Cuban American just offered Cuba $5 million in humanitarian aid. By the way, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that would have been impossible. I said nobody would have ever done that. But the guy who did this, Santiago Alvarez, he's no softy. He's been a long time, I guess you would call him, I guess, a hardliner in our community. And he put his money where his mouth is. The government said no. But do you think that was a good first step? Do you think that was a gesture of many gestures? Or where do you think the diaspora is right now on this bridging,
Look,
if you will?
I consider Santiago Alvarez my friend. His life story is fascinating. And his gesture was not just a gesture. It was a real effort to direct very needed humanitarian assistance through church organizations, NGOs, and not through government agencies. So I think that this is a test of credibility of the other side. I think that this is maybe one essential element in anything that can be called dialogue between Havana and, let's say, Miami. You know, as we speak, now we have 15 flights a day between Miami and Havana, packed with people trying to help their relatives, bringing them not only money, but anything they need. You have all these small entrepreneurs, but operating in totalitarian environment. So it rather turns them into opportunistic element in Cuban society. So I think that what needs to be found is a communication, then checks and balances. You can call it first confidence building measures, but there should be certain reciprocity. But I will tell you one more thing. Obviously, you live in Washington area, so policy of the United States towards Cuba is formulated in Washington, State Department, and maybe the White House people. And there is something going on here. You have we had an Obama period, then President Trump did something else, and now we can look at what the Biden's administration is doing. But I think it's extremely important to add to this dimension of communication between Cuba and the United States, direct link between Miami and Havana. Because Miami-Havana is a communication within Cuban nation. And people in exile, they are patriots. I think that they are doing what they are doing because they love their country. But obviously, the question is how to unify all these different perspectives, generational changes, the fact that if you live for six decades in dictatorship, you might see things differently from those who live here in the United States.
You know, I'm seeing so many people, by the way, you say that number, and it's a quite shocking number. It's more than a generation now. And you're seeing a new generation of potential civil society leader, dissident, just packing up and leaving, especially after the crackdown of July 11th. All these young people that even they come all the way to Maryland, to Washington. And a lot of them, when you talk to them, they're saying, look, we want to do something, but we just didn't get support. People just left us there. And we had no choice but to leave. I mean, what message do you have for the Cuban government when they when they do such a thing and they crack down on so many people so brutally the way they did, including young people, people in their teens, people that could have been engaged in their own Prague Spring, but were shut out of it?
Well, the message is very simple. To keep status quo means killing and destroying Cuban nation. They should be also thinking not only about the ideological projects and dreams that are over. I think the Castro World Revolution, let's say putting South against North, or how you can frame it, is a matter of the past. Cuba can be very successful case of democratization process. And so I think maybe there are some pragmatic leaders in Cuban leadership, both on the military side and in economic circles, that might be willing and able to think about the situation in different terms, not as a traditional doctrine has been forcing them to say in the past decades. So I think that there is a chance, there is a no certainty, but I think that young people, both on the island and here, should raise their voices. I have a good experience with my students. I do have a class here, a number of students in my class are from Cuban families, so mostly obviously born here, or all of them born here, but having relationship with Cuba. And if I read their papers, what does democracy mean for them? I think that it is a very serious and patient articulation of a love for their country, love for their background, and the readiness to do something for it. So I think that these positive elements and also international context, transatlantic cooperation in this area can produce in the end some movement. And we don't want to miss any opportunity to initiate, catalyze that movement, open channels of communication, and do the right thing.
I agree with you that we need to do a lot more on the island. In fact, we spend a lot of time. In fact, you mentioned U.S. policy and U.S. government programs, which are completely out of date. They spend a lot of money on things that are not, you know, it's funny, you hear the Cuban government complaining about these programs. Now they're taking money from USAID, but a lot of these programs are so out of date. People on the island are the ones looking for the help. They're not getting the help. And I think there's a lot of room there to fix that. And talking about politics briefly, we have a mutual friend, former Congressman Joe Garcia. He and I were talking recently before you published your piece about a lot of things, because I didn't really agree with the way the trip happened. You know, he was in Cuba recently. He did certain
things. I know.
But we had a good conversation about it. And Joe and I have known each other for a long time. He's known my wife a long time. We've known each other before he was a member of Congress. So, you know, it was kind of shocking to me to see the way the trip unfolded and why it happened the way it did. I understand the reasons why he did it, but I also don't understand if that's the way forward in potentially a less, or maybe a more organized way would have been better. But what do you think about that trip? And do you think we need more trips like it? And should there be a more structured way of doing this with a more ideologically diverse base of Cuban Americans and diaspora members on the other side as well, by the way, on the Cuban side?
Well, obviously, this trip can be seen from two different angles. A small group of Cuban American entrepreneurs having their own private interests were traveling just to strengthen cooperation with their partners on the island. I think that economic discussion is important, but it should not be separated from the political dimension of that process. Joe Garcia is an experienced person. I also know him for years. I don't want to say that I'm from his school of thought. I know that he has so many enemies here in Miami who like to call him traitor. I think that he is a well-meant and also Cuban patriot. So I would be the last to blame him for anything. Obviously, this trip brought him face to face with Díaz-Canel, and the president of Cuba said what he said. Obviously, one doesn't need to believe to trust these type of statements, because there were so many statements in the past and nothing happened. But I would always try to test it, to try to find out whether there is a chance here to do something. So I think that Joe Garcia's connectivity is something that at least needs to be taken note of or taken into consideration. And, you know, I'm not a businessman at all. I'm academic or teaching here at FIU with my also background of being a dissident. So what I'm doing, what I'm trying to do, has no economic motivation whatsoever. It is a really belief in certain ideas and solidarity between dissidents. So I think that I'm in touch with Joe Garcia. I'm trying to be in touch with everybody in Miami. I understand that now some people have a problem to understand what I'm up to, but I'm ready to explain to everybody what I mean. Because as Carlos Saladrigas likes to say, the basic fact is that they have power, and they are the one, the side that you cannot just avoid or eliminate. You need to talk with them, but obviously the talk with them, I would say, from the position of certain determination and strength. The community in Miami is not a position, not a weaker side. Economically, they are much more powerful. They have all tools how to start the real process of transformation with all the, and find a solution for all these humanitarian questions and infrastructure projects or everything. But the only thing you need is to agree on the language and to agree also how eventually we can go from A to B. I like to use mathematical metaphor. If you have a differential equations, then they can have an analytical solution, one formula how to get from A to B. But for many natural processes and political processes, these solutions are not existent. But we now have in our world numerical solutions. A numerical solution is that you step from A to A plus one, A plus two, A plus three, and you do smaller steps and only control that your solution is going into the right direction and not just going apart. So I think that it is always worthwhile to try something like that. If the Cuban government is still a bunch of fidelistas, so then it will be not a productive communication, but we need to find out.
Need to find out. In fact, I'm glad you raised that, because it touched upon two points, and then we're getting close to the end of our program. We've been talking with Czech diplomat, human rights defender, Martin Palaus with FIU, Foreign International University. And we touched upon various issues, but now you hit on something very interesting that I wanted to get your input on. You already mentioned it earlier. There's about 15 flights a day between the U.S. and Cuba. Remittances, depending on the numbers you use, according to one resource, it's about $1.5 billion a year. Another group says about $4 billion a year. This has been happening for a long time. So the connection between the U.S. and Cuba slowly, because the way the laws, by the way, folks, in the 1990s, there was the Cuban Democracy Act, then there was the Helms-Burton Law in 96, then there was the Trade Sanctions Reform Act. So there have been a series of laws that have been passed that have slowly, even though people like to say the evil embargo is suffocating Cuba, I disagree with that. I think it's gone the other way. I think the laws haven't been enforced, partly because of politics, partly because there has been a lack of political will. But for whatever reason, there are flights every day. The remittances are in the billions of dollars. There has been a lot of back and forth, multi-generational back and forth between the U.S. and Cuba. And what Ambassador Palaus is talking about is, you know, we got to focus on this from the U.S. national interest and what is best for us and what is not best for us. And right now, it makes, frankly, no sense to me that the Chinese are going in there, the Russians are going in there again. They have never left. They've been there all this time. On the other hand, as much as I want to displace the Russians and the Chinese and Cuba's belligerent national security posture toward America, because let's face it, they even lock up American citizens. We represent an American citizen from Miami, Alina Lopez from Miami, who was falsely accused of espionage, which, by the way, Elizardo Sanchez was one of the very first ones that came and told me she did not do what the Cubans said they did, and hopefully she'll be home soon. But on this issue of U.S. interests, of foreign policy, of moving the needle the other way, do you see there's an opportunity now with what's happening in Cuba, given its delicate situation and the domestic political situation here, where you can't seem to get the camps to work together on anything?
Well, there are certain things, such as U.S. assistance to Cuba when this fire started in Denver, and maybe changes in U.S. Visa policy. Certainly, Cubans also have some expectations, especially in the area of remittances and maybe easing of a banking sector. The big question, obviously, is should Cuba be removed from the list of countries supporting terrorism, and so on and so forth. So I would rather suggest to turn this communication, non-communication, into some sort of productive exchange. And it seems to me that Cuban regime, as it is right now, is in such a weak position that they know that some change must happen. And Chinese or Russian assistance, I don't think it is an alternative for them. Russians have their own problems at this moment. And I don't think that Chinese card is even good for the communist government of Cuba. So I think that the best shot for them would be, as I've said, a reunification of Cuban nation and making Cuba something different from what it was in past more than six decades. And I'm born optimist. I think that such a change is possible. It's not inevitable, but as an opportunity, it must be tried and tested.
I agree. It needs to be tried. And finally, one of the last questions for you, Martin. What is there a role, if any, for the Catholic Church or the Catholic movement in Cuba? Do you think they're a factor in this?
Of course. You know, I know Roberto Valdez for ages, and I understand that the role of Cardinal Ortega was problematic. Strange thing is that Cuba is a very special country visited by three popes, one after another, in the past decades. So the Catholic Church, churches are not should be very cautious to over politicize their mission. Their mission is different, but obviously they should be able to administer humanitarian assistance, to cultivate certain things, to turn themselves into, as my friend Czech Catholic priest Tomáš Halík says, some sort of hospitals in war zones. And churches can, I would say, preach the spirit of reconciliation. That's exactly what their main message, I think, is to be. And I think church is an institution that has its own modus operandi. And this modus of operandi can be extremely effective when it is used properly with also strong backing or support from other, from similar religious groups here in the United States and all over the world. So yes, church can play very positive and significant role in the process of transition.
So where do we go to next as we wrap up? What should the next phase of this process be? What do you think needs to happen here? And what do you think needs to happen over there?
Well, I think that's Joe Garcia believes that the other side is ready to do something. I am ready to test this option, to ask the other side what do they propose, because they must know that the position of Cuban Americans here is rather, I would say, skeptical as far as their good intentions are concerned. So some sort of confidence building measures must be suggested, but the ball is on the on the island. They must show something. For instance, releasing political prisoners would be a good gesture. But if they want to stick to their ideological dogmatic position, nothing is going to happen.
We've been talking with Czech diplomat Martin Palaus with Florida International University, longtime human rights advocate and staunch defender of the free people of Cuba. Thank you for joining us, sharing your views. I hope people read the Miami Herald op-ed. We are posting it on the program notes. We're going to try and reach out to Joe Garcia to see if he'll join us here as well to hear his side of the story. That should make for some lively conversation. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you have a great rest of the week.
Thank you for having me, and happy Advent, because it is a time when maybe a small light is growing in the darkness.
Amen. Happy Advent. Have a great Christmas season. And I look forward, maybe I'll see you in Miami. I'll be down there to see my relatives down there.
Okay. hopefully to see you.
Thanks for joining us, sir. Take care.
Thanks. Take care.